Hello, everyone. Today, I will be sitting down with our guest, Jennifer Special, who, as an executive recruiter, has had the opportunity to work on behalf of some of the largest corporations in the world, such as Google, Amazon, McKinsey, Indeed. Notably, at Indeed, Jennifer was the first full-time recruiter who worked alongside the CEO to develop Indeed's long-term global recruiting and hiring goals. She sought out for many things, including career transitions, seeking a promotion, how to become a better storyteller, interviewing, and obviously recruiting. You have now specialized into the design field, I believe, and we will discuss more about that. I'm very excited to have you here to discuss the career of an executive recruiter. How are you doing, Jennifer?
I'm good, thank you.
Let's start off really broad. What is an executive recruiter?
So in recruiting, there's typically two big broad categories. One is kind of what you would call a corporate recruiter, and then one is what you might call a headhunter. Headhunters are focused on recruiting people for multiple companies. You could work for a staffing agency, you could be independent, you could be dedicated to one company, and then there are different kinds of ways of being paid, compensated as a headhunter. There could be a contingency fee. There could be an hourly rate. You could be paid only after the hire or part of the hire until the hire is acquired. They're all different kinds of compensation schemes for a headhunter. And there's a little more independence. And typically headhunters have to find that business. So it's a different kind of entrepreneurialism to be a headhunter. And they run what we call running a full desk. So you're seeking the clients and you're also seeking the candidates and you're making the match. I have spent my career as what I would call a corporate recruiter. And that's where you are embedded in the organization and the people that you hire are for your organization, not for various organizations. For me, it was more fulfilling. It has always been more fulfilling because the people that you hire, they're walking around. You're building an organization. Your relationships that you build with candidates don't end. I'm terrible. I always fall in love with my candidates. They really become part of my life, whether they're hired or not. They're people that I've stayed in touch with. Some of my clients now are people that I hired a decade ago as an intern. So they're really people that stay with me, and probably headhunters have the same kinds of relationships. For me, I just wanted to be part of that, building the beehive and being part of the beehive and seeing the organization grow and evolve and prosper. That really is what does it for me.
I mean, that sounds awesome because it seems like your network just keeps expanding. And where does the executive part come from? Is that just like a overarching title?
Right. So executive comes from the level that you're recruiting. So recruiter is a very general title. And some people might recruit people at the executive level and still call themselves a recruiter. At Amazon, I was recruiting only people at the VP level and above. So that means people with 20 to 25 years of experience. So executive recruiting, for me and my profession, that's what that means. There are executive recruiters at places like Korn Ferry, and that typically means you could still be recruiting somebody that's junior level, but it's called executive recruiting for that organization and similar organizations because you have an executive methodology. You do a very thorough intake of the candidate. You submit very thorough interview notes to the client. It's all very polished and there's, you know, it's probably on a letterhead and even an email. It's a different level of service and companies will pay for that. So different from an external staffing agency where you just send resumes and a write-up. You do different things, maybe similar things to a Korn Ferry, but historically, executive recruiting for staffing agencies or places like that, that's what that means. But for me, executive recruiting means the level of the candidate that I was responsible for hiring.
Okay, fair enough. How many years of experience do you have as a recruiter?
That's almost like asking a girl her dress size, but I'll say potentially if I take out the time that I was in graduate school and spent a couple of years as a product adoption specialist, almost probably like around 20 years, give or take.
So why is that a controversial question?
Well, because, you know, I wouldn't want you to think I started working at age 12, but, you know, I have been working for a lot of years.
Okay.
Most of my career in recruiting.
Fair enough. So how'd you get into recruiting? Why did you choose this as a career path?
So for me, like a lot of recruiters, I fell into it. It was completely an accident. I haven't ever met a single recruiter that went to school to be a recruiter. It's kind of an ambiguous, strange profession that a lot of people stumble into. In fact, I studied neuroscience in undergrad and was on my way to NIH, National Institutes of Health, and just realized that that wasn't my jam. I'm extroverted and spent a lot of time in a lab and, you know, doing different kinds of experiments for drugs. And the work that I did in the lab was very rewarding. We were trying to find better drugs for schizophrenics, and I later found out how that helped people. So that was good. But I was working I think I had four jobs at the time, just after undergrad, trying to figure out who I was and what the heck I was going to do with my life and one day not only live on ramen noodles. And I was working in a clothing store, and a girl came in one evening who seemed to be about my age, maybe a little bit older, and she was just buying everything off the racks. And I was like, wow, so what's the celebration? She said, oh, I'm celebrating my new job. And I said, oh, where are you leaving? Because I thought whatever her one job was, it was maybe better than my four. Yeah. And she said, I'm so glad you asked, because I've been watching you with other customers and I think you'd be an amazing recruiter. And I was like, oh, for the military? Because I'd never heard of recruiting. And I was trying to picture myself in camos and maybe I could, you know, put a belt on in some way, like dress up the camo. I was like, I don't know if I could do that. You know, I don't like guns. And she said, no, for software engineers. So I was like, oh, amazing. What does that mean? So we decided to meet. And in fact, we met. She helped network me in. I had six different interviews. I had seven offers, six from the places she networked me and one from her company where she was leaving. I still didn't even know what I was interviewing for. And I took the job with the manager that I liked the most. And she turned out to be one of my best mentors to this day of my career. She taught me everything she knew. She was definitely one of the world's best recruiters. And I couldn't believe it. You know, all those bad conduct grades growing up, and there I was being paid to talk to people and be nosy. I thought, I can't even believe this exists.
So you got recruited into this profession.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And here we are.
Here we are.
So, I mean, now you're an executive leader in the industry. So that is really, really awesome. I mean, before I get into more of my regular interview questions, you have recruited on behalf of Goliaths, like Amazon, Google, Indeed. So I'm really interested, what did you learn from those companies? I'm sure, you know, I worked at Capital One and I was dumbfounded at how well organized and how systematic things were. And I loved it. A lot of people hate it, but I just think good systems produce consistent results. Working and recruiting on behalf and being intimately involved in Indeed's like global strategy, what did you learn from working at such big, big companies?
Yeah. So, you know, when I was at Indeed, it was really building the spaceship as we were flying it, which turns out to be something that I loved because it was a repeat, a common thread in my career. I would say the biggest takeaway is to have a really solid interview process and really, really thoughtful interview questions. You want to try to eliminate bias in your interview questions, and you want to have questions that garner the right information. ideally objective information about a person's skill set. One of my favorite things that I learned at Amazon was that saying somebody is or is not a culture fit, those are dirty words, culture fit. And for me, that was eye-opening. I mean, I've been a recruiter for forever, and I had never heard of that. Culture fit is, they're kind of like industry words that we blanket for everything when we can't describe why or why not a person is a fit. And it turns out that those are really bad words because it doesn't speak to the person's ability. And yet it can have the effect of really labeling a person. And God forbid you tell a candidate that they weren't a culture fit, they go away the rest of their life wondering what's wrong with them. And so I spent a lot of time telling people, listen, you're looking for a match as well as we are. So if we find you're not a fit, you have to remember that we're saving you because that means you wouldn't be happy here. But having really well-crafted interview questions to glean information about a person's skill set, ideally, the other things will follow. If somebody isn't hitting the mark for other reasons about, you know, a company's mission or the way that the processes are done, those are different things. But just the blanket culture fit statement is not good. And the other thing is a well-crafted interview process. There's nothing worse than having no idea where you are in the process. We've all experienced it, myself included, wondering how you did on one interview to the next, getting the call, you know, a week or 2 weeks later, and they're like, you're invited back. And you're like, oh, thank God, I've just died the past 2 weeks waiting to hear from you. No idea. That's not a well-designed interview process. And I don't care how busy somebody is, you know, for a recruiter to say they're too busy to give feedback to candidates or keep them apprised of the situation. Guess what? Everybody's busy. That's not an excuse. Everybody should have a really clear understanding of where they fit in the process. And I also think candidates are owed a really good understanding of what will be expected of them. I can't stand this question of like, tell me about yourself. What does that mean? Like, tell you my hobbies, tell you my favorite wine, tell you my favorite skill set about myself, tell me how I could fit in your organization. Like, what do you want to hear on that? It's such a terrible question. It's so ambiguous. What does it actually glean? If somebody's going to ask that question, they need a really specific qualifier that goes with that. And a really good recruiter paired with the candidate to help them survive the interview process. I think nothing could make a person feel more vulnerable than a job interview process. It's, you're standing naked in front of people you've never met, like more than once. And it can be very jarring. It can bode poorly for the match. If a candidate doesn't know exactly what's expected of them, they can't present themselves well. And then the company doesn't learn what they should about the candidate. And then you may not have a good match. And the hiring manager might be hiring somebody because they like them, which is not really the recipe for success. So I have very strong opinions about a very clear, well-crafted interview process and well-crafted interview questions.
Fair enough. I've been on the wrong end of the catch-all culture fit. So I know how that feels. I think it's really damaging in the beginning of your career because you don't have much confidence. Obviously, you're not competent in your craft. And so to not be a cultural fit, it sends a lot of odd messages.
For my clients that I coach at the executive level, it's terrible to hear that because they're thinking, what are you talking about? I have, you know, potentially master's degrees from the best universities. I've worked for the best companies under the best mentorship. I've led enormous teams. I've delivered products that nobody else could have. How could I not be a culture fit? It's just such an awful, insulting blanket statement. Tell me something specific. I'm too good for you. Okay, great. I can take that. But tell me something.
Well, that's how I hear it now. That's what I kind of meant. Like in the beginning of my career, if somebody told me that, I would just be in this space of lack, right? But now that I've worked, I've been in the market for 10 years. Somebody tells me I'm not a fit. My thought is like, honestly, thank you. I don't want to be part of this, right? Like, I know I bring value, right? Yeah. Like, once you know you bring value, I feel like you walk around differently, and you just don't care. And I did hear that a lot. So landing my first articling position in Canada, in order to become an attorney, you have to finish law school, all that stuff, get accredited, pass your bar exam, and then do 10 months of working under the supervision of an attorney. Hmm. It's like a hostage scenario where you can't become an attorney unless you get these 10 months.
Hostage or apprentice?
I'd like to say apprenticeship. Now they've actually created another route in which you can go through a program to get those 10 months satisfied. But in the beginning, that didn't exist, and you essentially had to get those 10 months. And so now imagine there's like 10,000 applicants. There's not that many jobs, right? So there's people that had to wait multiple years just to get this apprenticeship before they can call themselves an attorney. Mm. And so during that time, I remember hearing I'm not a cultural fit. And I'm like, man, we know nothing. How can we or not be a cultural fit?
Right, I'm neutral.
Yeah, it's like we're pretty much like cheap labor at this point, and we're supposed to learn the culture. But anyways, we can talk about this. This could be an entire episode. Thank you so much. That's awesome. I did notice when I went to Capital One, they had an incredible, very thorough interview process. And I mean, their questioning was crazy. They had like 6 hours of interview. So, I mean, that was something else. But I would like to discuss... on each episode, I like to break down for like an 18-year-old, 19-year-old. If I know you said that recruiting is something like people fall into, so maybe it's a secondary profession, but what are the exact steps you have to take in order to become a recruiter? Are there prerequisites?
I would say, so prerequisites in terms of professional skills, not necessarily. But the prerequisites in terms of a person and their skill set, yes. It may sound cliche. This is probably true of many professions, but for recruiting, it's really a survival. It's absolutely survival is innate curiosity. You know, this constant quest to find the right person and then to talk to people, dig into their experience, be nosy in a professional way. And I think that my insatiable curiosity is part of why I've loved recruiting. I've recruited in so many different industries, particularly in down economies when recruiting, you know, there were no recruiters and everybody was laid off. You have to pick up and recruit anything that you can. And I think if you have this curiosity about humans and about their story, and their own professional journey, that will bode well for you, because then you also have to be curious about the company, the organization, the business strategy. How does this person fit into that or not? And then, of course, curiosity about hiring managers. What makes them tick? Do they hire in their own likeness, or are they looking for somebody completely different than they are? Do they need somebody who can just take a lot of things off their plate, or are they looking for somebody to grow and mentor and evolve? You have to ask a lot of questions at every point in making that match. And if you have that natural curiosity, it helps you because you can't help yourself. You want to know all of the facets.
Mm-hmm. So this would fall more under like a general characteristic, right? Like that is a requirement in order to prosper as a recruiter. So suppose Billy wants to become a recruiter. Can he just start? Does he need any degree? Does he need experience in the field that he or she is recruiting? If I'm young and I'm trying to get into recruiting, where would you tell me to look, and what are the steps that you would advise a young person interested in the career path?
Yeah. So the first step I would say is to spend time reaching out to recruiters. Create two separate tracks. One where you're researching headhunters or staffing recruiters. Talk to a number of different people at staffing agencies. Interview them. Ask them questions about what it's like to work there. Don't have in your mind you need a job, you need to have them like you, you need to be accepted. Pay attention to the story. Ask them what their day-to-day is like. Ask them what gives them energy about the job. Ask them what doesn't give them energy. And then create another track with another list of people that are corporate recruiters or executive recruiters or all of, you know, all of those things. And spend lots of time talking to different recruiters and learn what makes them tick. And as you learn about those different people and their professions and their stories, it will inform your own story and your own profession and the kind of environment that might be interesting for you. Not only because recruiting as a profession itself, but which industry do you want to be in? Do you want to be in healthcare? Because then you're really affecting change for medical professionals. Do you want to be in social work? There's a recruiter for everything. My brother has been a social worker for years, and I'm always telling him, you should be a recruiter for social workers. It does help if you have some kind of industry knowledge. For example, if you had gone to law school, and I saw this a lot when I did legal recruiting, sometimes people finish law school and they're like, I don't want to practice law. I don't want anything to do with that, but I want to stay amongst lawyers because I loved what I learned. There are legal recruiters with law degrees, and it makes a great match because that recruiter can ask very specific questions. They have the expertise. Maybe I know designers that didn't want to practice design anymore, and so they became design recruiters. There are all different kinds of recruiters for different industries. For somebody who's just starting out, you could think maybe you loved a certain class. Maybe there was a class that you took that was very interesting. So do a Google search for recruiters related to that profession. They're probably in existence. Or maybe there's a startup. And having those kinds of various conversations with people, part of why it's so important, and I tell all of my clients, and especially people coming right out of undergrad, don't apply to things online because it's usually just a black hole. Having these, what I call life design interviews, are the best way to build your knowledge of what you're looking for. So you may think that you had a super passion for sports medicine, for example. There are sports medicine recruiters, and I have always loved sports and I'm very athletic. And I thought, oh God, to be a sports medicine recruiter in some way, that would be a dream. So I had some conversations with sports medicine recruiters, and I found like, it's actually kind of boring. It's not the glamour that I thought that it would be. So thank goodness that saved me from like applying to a bunch of sports medicine jobs. I was able to just sneak in, learn the industry, learn more about the different roles, and then not really pursue that track.
Fair enough.
I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it did. So in terms of prerequisites, there aren't, but that doesn't seem to be the entire story because you need to take the initiative to learn the industry and kind of find your place before you can just dive in. Because, I mean, you might end up hating the career path if you supposedly went into sports medicine, right?
Yeah.
And you would have been like, I hate this. And you could have just been in a slightly different industry and loved it altogether. I know for a fact that, I mean, as an attorney, you get recruited all the time. I think they have, I don't know where they get your information, but they just somehow you get lots of emails. And I can say to date, there's been like two recruiters who have just been mind-blowingly good. And they have like a special knack for just, I don't even want to talk to them, and somehow they'll talk to me, right? And we'll have a lovely conversation. And so when you said professional nosiness, I was like, there's this one recruiter, and she like messaged me. She hit me up on Zoom. She sent me an email. And I was like, okay, I'll take this call, right? And I took this call, and it was a lovely call. And she was very helpful. And so it's really, really awesome. So essentially,
and it's even interesting that you said she was helpful. I mean, she was just figuring out if you could be a candidate, but somehow you actually got something from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Now that I've had conversations with like 15 recruiters, 20 recruiters, I don't know. I can tell really quickly if I want to continue talking, because there's the standard just going through the job spec and trying to figure out whether you're a fit or not. Yeah. And then there's a recruiter that's genuinely just, they're just prying about you.
Yeah.
Right. And they're asking like these very thoughtful questions with respect to what do you actually want? Right. And they're so concerned about your wants and needs and stuff like that. Where are you currently and things of that nature? So the professional nosiness again. So it was, it's interesting. But
it makes a difference, because there's nothing worse than when somebody, you finally decide to take the call with a recruiter, and it's clear that they've done no research on your background, mm-hmm. and they're trying to pitch you jobs that have no relevance to your background. And sure, we're all kind of open to something really different every now and then, especially if it's something we never considered, but it is actually interesting. But it will benefit everybody if the recruiter has some information about the person and shows that.
I mean, on that note, it was crazy. This is what kind of took me back. This recruiter, she's a senior recruiter. She knew so much about me. I'm like, how did you get this information? Right. And then on top of that, she's like, there's a specific attorney that wants to speak with you. They'll be in DC at this and this time. And it's a no obligation conversation. And just, I was just like, how did she lure me into this? Right.
Yeah,
and
that's good. I'm proud of her.
Yeah, she was amazing. I think the reason why that conversation I got lured into was because she knew so much about me. She knew exactly, like in like probably like a 3-minute conversation, she had a very solid idea of what I wanted because she did so much research on me. And I'm no big shot. Like, I'm a normal attorney. And so for her to take the time and, do the
go
diligence.
Deep.
Yeah, I was just like, and she's the only recruiter I respond to now. Actually, no, there's two. Anyways. Whew. So in terms of going back to the question was, what are the kind of steps? And your advice to somebody who's very young would be
have
curious. Out of the two branches of an executive recruiter, a recruiter, a corporate recruiter, and a headhunter, break it down, go speak to both of them, lifestyle questions, and kind of see where you fit. Also work on what type of industry you'd be interested in. So those are the type of recruiters you want to reach out to. And going through that exercise will give you a good understanding and help you kind of navigate how to land a recruiting job.
Yeah.
Sound
and
good?
I would just say one clarification, not lifestyle interviews, but life design. And I call it that because you are designing your life. You're figuring out how you want to spend your time. And we spend most of our time at work. So thinking about those interviews, some people call them coffee chats. You can call them whatever you want. I call them life design interviews with my clients because I want to reinforce the message that you are designing your life. You are in control. And if you take this big ambiguous challenge, which is finding a job, and what could be more daunting than trying to get a job when you haven't ever had a job, except it's something I know when I finished undergrad, I had lots of like really random jobs and some lab work, but nothing that really drew a complete picture. So you're trying to articulate to interviewers who you are and you don't even know yet. So having informal life design interviews or coffee chats, just getting stories from people, informs how you will present yourself. And in fact, what you're actually doing subconsciously is building your own brand. Even if you're 18 years old and you're just starting out, you still have a brand. You're just evolving that. And the best way to evolve that is to start doing it. And the way to start doing that is to by talking to people and getting feedback. You are, whether they tell you something about yourself or not, you yourself, by the way they react to you, you're starting to get that feedback. And that gives you cues. And you're filling your own inventory of what gives you energy or what doesn't, what interests you or doesn't. And so as you do that, you become better able to promote yourself and understand yourself and then go in the direction of what you're looking for.
You brought up a great point. This is something I struggle with. What factors should you consider when crafting a professional, like not a professional, when crafting your own brand, right? Because it took me a very long time to understand this. And this was a big thing at Capital One, because you realize you have a reputation, and just having a reputation of doing good work is not sufficient. And I feel like it helped me a lot to actually start thinking of myself as a brand. So what advice would you give to young people who should create a brand of themselves at each workplace, and two, to recruiters with respect to the same?
You're right. Brand is really important. You want to project yourself in the way that you want to be seen. And that sounds very intuitive, but people don't actually always follow that. You know, if it's very common for people to feel misunderstood or feel like people just don't understand them. You're in charge of communicating yourself, and people automatically assume you know yourself better than they do. And that's probably true. So you want to project yourself in the way that you want to be seen and remembered and ultimately hired. So if you want to join a law firm, you want to project yourself in the way that lawyers represent themselves. Maybe that means wearing a suit. Even if you hate suits, if you want to be in and around lawyers, maybe you wear a suit. Maybe that's part of it. If you really hate suits and you can't stomach that, then maybe that's not the area for you. Or maybe you find a startup that you could be around lawyers and they don't care what you wear. You have to just think about what your goal is and then project yourself to match that goal.
That is great advice. I had a similar thought process. I think my brand changed when I worked at Capital One and when I worked at a law firm, because I wanted to be an easygoing, high meticulous brand at at Capital One.
Exclusive. Easygoing, meticulous.
Exactly, right? Easygoing in terms of my demeanor with respect to how I communicate and how I interact with people and have fun and jovial. Whereas when it came to my work product, it's like, I know for a fact that our work product will be opened up at some point, right? And you want as high of attention to detail as possible. So I wanted to be meticulous with my work, but I want it to be fun and easy to work with. Whereas when you work at a law firm, it's different, right? You can't be easygoing and that easygoing in comparison. I'm still easygoing. I don't think I can change that part of my life. I don't like to take myself too seriously, except for my work. Work has to be maniacally, I'm crazy about work products. So attention to detail is like a huge thing for me, but you do have to think about that, and how you want to be projected is a good way. I'm gonna have to sit down and reflect on that, and then maybe I'll probably make some changes, because I think I would fall under the camp of I haven't done the exercise, so people probably perceive me differently than I want to be projected. So thank you for the personal advice as well. So you said it'll definitely help you if you have industry knowledge with respect to the field that you recruit in, right? When you first started, you had no clue. So, and most people, unless they're like lawyers that want to change fields and start legal recruiting, how do you penetrate the market if you don't have experience in the field?
I always tell people that interest and ambition can pull you over anything that you lack. So if you demonstrate genuine interest in you know, X organization or whomever you're speaking to, and promote yourself as somebody that's very hardworking and keen to learn, and find every objection to be something that is to your advantage. I tell my people who are trying to make an industry transition, for example, if I have a client that wants to transition out of, you know, a technology organization into a healthcare organization, I tell them that whatever objection an interviewer gives, you articulate why that's actually an advantage. And usually the advantage is, if you don't know something, that's great, because you are a blank slate to learn everything that there is to know. And that is exactly why you're making that transition. So for somebody coming right out of undergrad, or somebody who's 18 and trying to get a first job, the fact that they have no experience, you have to demonstrate that is your advantage. You are in some ways a blank slate. You have all the energy in the world and all the ambition to put towards learning this job. And you will learn it exactly the way that they articulate, or I was going to say dictate, but that sounds a little harsh. Learn it exactly in the way that they want to, because you don't have a lot of competing information and old ways of doing things and lots of managers. Well, at my last company, we did it like this. You don't have any of those things. So you have to reframe the challenge as being a disadvantage to being all the advantage in the world, maybe more advantageous than somebody that's very senior level. And in fact, many times that does add up. That is accurate. Some of my most senior hires in my career had the most difficulty making the transition at an organization because they just knew too much. They already had so much prestige and respect and worked at the highest levels and commanded respect and budget and anything they wanted. And to go in a new organization, practically naked of their internal network, naked of the respect, lacking all of those things that they spent so many years building up, it's really hard to start over. So you have to reframe that and find those things as advantages. And so for somebody that's 18, you have to make that your complete advantage and demonstrate your eagerness and your humility. And humility is always the best ingredient for learning.
So, you know, I don't know about all 18-year-olds. Some are special, some aren't. but what would you recommend they do in order to come off or be perceived as professional? I mean, you don't have a professional brand because you haven't typically worked in an industry. You typically haven't been put in positions where you actually have to articulate large, lengthy, coherent sentences and things of that nature. So how would you tell them? Because your projection is a big thing, right? I mean, you can say a whole bunch of things, but if you're talking to an executive recruiter who is their bread and butter is hiring people and seeing talent, like, how would you advise? You're a keynote speaker as well, right? So what advice would you give to kids with respect to how to project yourself to a recruiter to land that first job, essentially? Because it's not going to be easy, right?
Right. So I hired droves of very junior level people into sales positions when I was first building Indeed.com. And I would say most of them had no experience whatsoever. And so I would talk to them about class projects, particularly senior year. Were they part of volunteer organizations? Did they have a certain, you know, class project that they worked very hard on? One guy had done some class project analyzing something in Ecuador, and I don't know, it was impressive. It doesn't have to be wildly exotic or impressive. You don't have to have gone to like the best private high school or any of those things, but find some story in your background that really highlights you as a person and your abilities. Because whomever is hiring you at that level, they are hiring you on your potential. When you get a little farther in your career, they're hiring you on your past and your potential. Right now, it's all about your potential. So you have to draw on the past that you do have. And the fact that you are alive and you're old enough to be applying for a job shows you have some past. So what in that past can you articulate? Pick one story, pick two stories, and make sure you practice those stories with really good details. You want a start and a stop, and be able to articulate those stories and your contribution. Anything can be made into a well-articulatable story that demonstrates your abilities and your potential. And you're giving insight to that person about what you can or maybe cannot do and where you may or may not be a fit. And I remember when I was talking to all of these young people, I had one candidate that had a paper route. He had a super poor background, according to him, and there weren't a lot of jobs where he grew up. And so he started a paper route, and then he got to know all of the customers. And some of the customers asked him to do odd jobs. And there was an elderly lady on his paper route, and he started washing her car. And then there was somebody else that needed babysitting. And he just found ways of making more money. It started with his paper route because there was nothing else to be done. There weren't a lot of places around where he could work, and he couldn't afford a car. So he found other ways to make money. That story was so captivating. The CEO was blown away. And he had no other experience than that. And he was an instant yes. We hired him, and he became a really, really successful salesperson. And he's probably still at Indeed today. I should probably track him down.
Wow. So, sorry, continue.
Yeah, I was just going to say, find stories in your background, who you are today. You need to have pride about who you are. Everybody has a different kind of background and brings something. There is something, but you have to think about what it is, because you know yourself better than anybody else does. So find your story and articulate that, and have the story match whatever you're going towards. So if you're not talking to a salesperson, maybe some amazing entrepreneurial example doesn't work for a lab job, but maybe it does. Maybe in a lab, you still have to be, you know, really push yourself and self-starter and all of those things. Find the commonalities and whatever story you develop that match the person that you're talking to and what their interests will be in you.
Cool. Well, I hope that helps. Definitely helped me. I'm going to watch this interview again and kind of revise how I do things. Thankfully, I don't need a job right now, but I'll get in touch with you when I do. So you've glossed over this indirectly in multiple ways. So to become a successful recruiter, what type of characteristics do you need? And you told me already you need an insatiable curiosity, and you also coined the term professional noisiness. What else would you think a recruiter needs to succeed?
Persistence. Absolutely never giving up, not for any reason. It's all about timing and reminding yourself of that daily. And you have to be very self-motivated. You have to focus on the goal. Whatever the goal is, if it's hiring a certain number of people, if it's hiring a certain kind of person, whatever the goal is, have the goal very specific and very clear in your mind, and then drive towards that. And don't stop until you do. Uncover every stone looking for the right person. I can remember in the old days trying to find software engineers of this huge organization. I couldn't break through to anybody. I accidentally got somebody on the phone in the mailroom, and he happened to be really good friends with a guy that was in the software engineering department and transferred me to his friend. I had a conversation with that guy. He wasn't interested in making a change, but the guy sitting next to him was. So I got his name, and long story short, I ultimately pulled that whole team out of the organization. So just finding ways any way that you can to accomplish your goal and not being afraid.
Sounds like you need to be a little extroverted. Like an introvert wouldn't do well here because it requires you to kind of get out there, have conversations with randoms. You don't know who you're going to bump into, and you need to capitalize on those opportunities. Like I'll give you an example. The other day I was at Starbucks and I saw this guy with his laptop and he had C plus and all these things on it. And I was like, are you into development? And he's like, yeah. And he turned out to be an incredibly passionate game developer. And so I was like, hey, want to come on the podcast and talk about game development? And turns out the guy is awesome. Like, I mean, he's developed like big games and he works at a huge game studio. So am I right to say that you should be extroverted in this profession, at least to succeed?
I think years ago, I would have said resounding yes. But now there's been so much research done on introverts. And in fact, at McKinsey, there were so many introverts who McKinsey lived and breathed by the MBTI. We all had to take the MBTI personality test because it helps inform how you work on teams and how you work with people. So people really lived by their designation. And there were a lot of introverts. And you couldn't believe X person was an introvert. And so people would call themselves like, oh, well, I'm a well-trained I. And I started thinking, I'm kind of a well-trained E, because in my younger years, like I just had so much energy. It was really hard to contain that. And I feel like over the years I've learned to like contain it a little bit. But the well-trained I could also be a recruiter. In fact, I know well-trained I's that are very successful recruiters, people that you couldn't imagine were introverts. Research tells us that the whole thing about introversion, extroversion, a lot of it is how you recharge and how you get your energy. And I would say I probably am a blend of E and I, because I can spend my day talking to people all day and then I have to recharge. I have nothing left for a little while until I am alone doing nothing, or like I'm at the gym in solitude on the treadmill, whatever it is. So I really think that you could be a very successful recruiter as an introvert or an extrovert. Introverts are maybe just more strategic in how they accomplish their goals. Maybe extroverts are, you know, going about things in a slightly different way. But I really believe that it could be for either. I think either could be very successful.
So I guess the ability to communicate with randoms would probably be a good skill to have, right? Yeah. Regardless of your personality, how to capitalize on those opportunities, because an opportunity can lie anywhere, right?
Yeah.
So we have persistence, professional nosiness. I love that. Insatiable curiosity, and a self-motivated individual will succeed as a corporate recruiter.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. What type of person would not like this job, or this field does not suit them?
I would say somebody who is not exclusively, but somebody who struggles with ambiguity. Sometimes you're talking to a hiring manager and you're trying to figure out what they want, who they want to hire, and they don't know themselves. And so if you're not comfortable with ambiguity to ask clarifying questions and you're frustrated by that, that might not be great for you. For me, I actually love that. If somebody knows, you know, there's an exact job description, sometimes that's a little bit boring. You know what you have to go after, but there's so much beauty. My favorite hire, for example, was not hiring the square peg for the square hole, but hiring the rhombus, the person that doesn't have X, Y, and Z. They've got like A, B, and Z, but there's some combination of those skills that actually makes that seemingly not perfect hire the most perfect hire, because with their different edges or different sides, like a rhombus, they become a better fit somehow. And so being comfortable with ambiguity has its advantages. You have more room to play. You have more opportunity for creativity, both in who you hire and who you present to your hiring managers. And then you can articulate why you're presenting a rhombus, what it was about that person that makes you want to present them. But the ambiguity, you have to be confident and comfortable swimming around in, because sometimes you're the one that's defining it. You're the one that's creating the definition.
Okay. Would you say that's the only characteristic that would kind of suffer in this field?
Well, I was going to say not liking fast pace, but that could just be the places where I've worked. Probably there are recruiters who work for normal, calm places that have a normal, slow pace of growth. Probably people that don't have a thick skin. Sometimes you're going to have a lot of rejection. You might call 10 candidates in a day and none of them want to talk to you, or none of them are looking to make a change, or you find the perfect person and they have no interest in making the change. You have to really have a thick skin and not see rejection as personal, just see it as part of the game. It's one of the pieces on the chessboard. So you understand that and you define how it is in the whole scheme of things, just like every chess piece has its own, like its own moves. So you see that in that way. You don't see rejection as a failure. You just see it as a piece of the puzzle.
It sounds like to me, you, if you're not independent, this might be a tough gig. Because I'm guessing that you have to manage a lot by yourself independently, and you kind of have to go, and you need a lot of organizational skills as well. You have to keep on top of things. And I guess that's why you have to be self-motivated as well. Does that sound right?
I say that does sound right. If you're fortunate enough to have a really good team, ideally you have people that you can talk to about some of the rejections. Maybe there's something in the way you're pitching an opportunity to candidates that's a turnoff. So if you have a good team and you have people that can be a sounding board, that is ideal, because it can be independent, and an independence has its pluses and minuses. So it is great if you have a good team to talk about some of those things, and even just to vent. Sometimes you'll just have an off day. You'll have some bad interviews, or something goes wonky, or you have the perfect candidate and then they bomb the interview and you've got an angry hiring manager and you have to manage the angry hiring manager. So if you have a good team to share those experiences with, because there's so many facets to it, then that's ideal. But yeah, ultimately it is kind of an independent role, which the positives are you could be a headhunter, you could be a contractor recruiter, you could be on your own and do many things. But if you're a corporate recruiter, it's really ideal to have a solid team around you.
Okay. In the industry, do you see a lot of young people join, or is it more like secondary jobs? Like you said, nobody really fell into it, right? They all fell into it. They never entered it, right?
I think more people enter it as a secondary career. Yeah. I think a lot of people, I definitely see a lot of young people falling into it, but it's such an excellent place to fall into. It can be a great starter career because there are so many facets. You learn everything about a business. You learn in many ways how to run your own business because you're managing so many different things. So it is something that even if you don't fall into it and you go into it as your first career, it's something that's great. It's an opportunity to learn lots of different industries deeply or not. You can choose that and meet really, really interesting people, because then your candidates, they might specialize in the industry you're in, but they might also have a very winding road. And it's inspiring because it informs your own life process. Like, wow, I don't have to be linear. Thank God for that. Because I think when you're, you know, starting college, finishing high school, you feel like you have no idea what the line is and you've got to follow a path. And I'll never forget, I had a girlfriend years ago when I lived in London, and she said, you know, I just thought accounting made sense. So I went to school to study accounting and now I'm an accountant. And I remember thinking, I wish I could have been like that, but I'm not built that way. And I don't know any other who's ever described themselves that way. So recruiting is an opportunity to learn so many different things about so many industries and not be linear, but you could be linear.
I think one really cool thing that I've learned during this interview is like, I feel like recruiters have a front row seat to what the world wants. right? Yeah. Like, you guys know firsthand that this is what the industry is seeking, yeah. right? And that's really cool. Because it I mean, really especially cool. if you're going into so many different industries, like, and you're managing different jobs, positions within the industry, it's quite a unique advantage.
It definitely makes you skeptical. Like, when you're watching the news, you're thinking, oh gosh, if this is on the news, it's already old. Or like all of those salary calculators, you know, you'll have candidates talk about, well, I did research and the salary calculator tells me this. Those are always outdated. It's just impossible for those to stay current. And most companies don't really divulge that information anyway. And it's always based on a person's unique background. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, in I agree law, with you. We have a scale. So it just gets posted online and firms are competing on who pays who more. So it's really funny.
That is funny. But firms yeah. are probably more homogenous than companies
yeah.
are.
Yeah, yeah.
Because companies have different sizes and profitability factors and all of those yeah. kinds of things. But that Definitely. Is interesting about law. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so like for quite some time, it used to be called the cravat scale. And that was because the law firm Cravath, and I forget, it's like four different partners, they had the highest paying amounts to attorneys. And so everybody said that they followed the cravat scale. And then I believe Milbank, another huge law firm, they up cravat, and so that everybody followed suit. And now it's the Milbank scale. So if you're market, you are paying Milbank now. Sooner or later, another law firm is going to come. It's probably going to be Latham. They're going to be like, hey, we pay our associates this much. And
we're the bar. Yeah, competition exactly. is always a good thing.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, if you go look at that scale, unbelievable. Hmm. But anyways, I've learned so much. I would love to know, what is an average and normal day like for a recruiter? Like, if I'm getting into the field, what should I expect to do on a normal day? I'm sure there's going to be ups and downs, but take me through your normal day as a recruiter.
Well, the interesting thing is, I know that the younger me would have said every day is different, but the older me knows that while every day could actually be different, the components of it should always be the same. You should understand yourself what kind of person you are. If you have high energy in the morning, you should block your time in the morning dedicated to reaching out to new candidates. Or if you're looking at being a headhunter, new clients or whatever the new is. If you're a morning person, put focus on where you have the most energy, because usually the outreach, the cold calling, the finding people, finding anything new, that takes the most energy. So dedicate that time to the day when you have the most energy. If you're more of a late day person, then block your time at the end of the day where you only focus on outreach when you have energy. Then block other time to do all your follow-up. I think being a good recruiter, the number one thing that I have always heard from my candidates over the years consistently is that I always have the best follow-up with people of anybody they've ever worked with. And that's because I'm very picky myself. I need to know exactly where I stand, and to have that ambiguity is annoying. And I see it as unprofessional. So I give that respect to all of my candidates, whether they're a viable candidate or probably not going to make it. I'll let them know how things are going, how they are in the process. So blocking your time very, very intentionally is the key to success, because every day, you know, because especially when you're first starting out, you're going to be with other recruiters at your same level, which means meetings. Recruiters can have a lot of meetings. Recruiting managers always want to know, like, who's coming in? Who are all the new candidates? What's filling the pipeline? Because it is the hardest part of the job for many people. So you're going to have to block time for your meetings, and you have to be very diligent about blocking time to find those candidates, to find the new people, and then to do your follow-up. And then the other big chunk of time is scheduling the interviews. You know, probably you have to schedule your own personal interviews, and then you have to schedule interviews for candidates with hiring managers or other interviewers. So being very intentional about blocking your time focused on each of those components will help to keep your machine going and to never come up empty when you need to get a hire and you don't have anybody, your pipeline's empty. You've got to always be filling that.
So that was awesome. Can we get a bit more granular? Like I'm trying to dictate like what are the little tasks? So like calling people, talking to a manager, updating your calendars, going through emails, things of that nature.
Yeah.
So like take me through, you get to the office. What should I expect to do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So get to the office, review emails, and start a list. What is burning? What's the biggest burning fire? You know, did an interview not go well yesterday and you have to do damage control with the hiring manager? Or is the candidate not happy about how the interview go? Try to figure out what's burning, because with recruiting, there's almost always something that's burning. You have to put out fires. So once you can get through putting out fires, then you should probably focus on building your pipeline. So reaching out to set a number of people, say 5 new people each day at a minimum, depending on the pace and the industry and the organization, you set the number. Set time aside to reach out to X number of new people a day. Maybe it's 20. Do your LinkedIn searches, look through your applicant tracking system, whatever it is, do new candidate outreach so that every single day you're reaching out to new candidates. Then you'll spend time doing follow-up, finding out how your candidates did on interviews, finding out if they're happy, finding out, you know, what the next steps are, if you've got to schedule next steps. Sometimes scheduling is a big time suck on you. Sometimes, depending on where you are, you have people that help with scheduling. Depends on the organization, but scheduling can be a big time commitment. So you'll need to take care of all of those things because you're always working towards the goal of getting hires. You've got to be very clear about that. It's so easy to go down rabbit holes and spend time doing other things, but you have to redirect yourself to always focus on getting the hire. So then also in there, you have to spend time going back to all of your warm leads. What about all of those people that are like you were? All of those people that would be your such ideal hire, but they just won't take your call. Send a little email, send a note. Who needs to be reached out to? Who told you to call them back in a month? Or which hiring manager said that they might have a new role opening in a month? Do all of that follow-up and be diligent about it.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of things going on. You definitely need good organizational skills. So, I mean, I heard get to the office, set out all fires, learn how to create a plan on how to address those, nurture leads.
Well, make leads.
Yeah, make leads. And then the ones that you have, also nurture those.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot of fires.
Keep moving people through the process.
Yeah, there's like multiple stages to this, and you're doing all of those stages every single day, concurrently.
And you could have, I mean, when I was at Digitas years ago in Manhattan, I can remember having 25 open roles, and if you think about ideally 3 candidates for each role. And those are just 3 candidates that qualify for interview processes. Maybe one role is in its early stages. You could have 10 candidates that you're trying to get through for one role. So you think about 25 roles, one role has 10 candidates, all the others have maybe 3 that are doing well, and you've got 3 interview processes going for each role times 25. It's a lot of follow-up. It's a lot of organization and staying on top. And I think that's why some recruiters aren't great at the follow-up, aren't great at staying in touch with people and letting them know what the heck is going on, whether it's candidates or even hiring managers, because hiring managers want their updates too. You know, I haven't even talked about all the reporting. Depending on the organization where you are and what's required, you might be required to give a reporting update every week. Maybe there's a report that goes to your hiring managers, and that goes to the recruiting manager. Maybe the recruiting manager does it for you. Who knows? But reporting is important. And all of that counts as feedback and keeping people updated. You've got a lot of people to keep updated. So there are a lot of spinning plates.
Well, I can definitely add that communication skills need to be on point as a characteristic to succeed.
Yeah.
because you need to communicate with everyone that you're trying to hire, all the managers, obviously the people that you need to report to. So I'm guessing your written communication skills also need to be pretty great.
Yeah.
It's really funny. I've had some really funny emails that I've received from recruiters that were very creative around like particular times, like Halloween or Christmas. And I get a really good chuckle out of them. And I'm like, I like their creativity. I remember there was this one recruiter that sent me an email. I think it was 420. So it was Cannabis Day or whatever. And they were hiring for the cannabis industry. And if you read that email, it was so funny. It was really, really creative. But I'm not interested in the industry, so I did not respond. But if I was, he or she, I definitely would have reached out to, because I had such a good laugh. Great written communication skills.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but you gave me both answers. So I want to get some clarity on this topic. Does being a recruiter require you to work within a team, or is it primarily independent? And the reason why I ask is because it seems like the work part of recruiting and everything is kind of independent, but you need a team in order to grow and improve. So take me through that. And what would you look at when you're trying to land your first job with respect to a team?
That's such a good, well-articulated question, because I don't know if you need a team to grow and improve. If for example, I'm thinking about myself when I was at startups and I was the only recruiter, you can still grow and improve your own skills, but there is so much benefit in mentorship. There is so much benefit in learning from other recruiting leaders. Certainly, you'll learn from your hiring managers, and they can be leaders and you can learn from them. But there is so much benefit from being on a really strong team with a really strong recruiting manager, because there are so many nuances in recruiting. To learn one person's turn of phrase or one person's way of managing up, you know, which means managing your manager and all of the other recruiting leaders and even hiring managers and their leaders, to learn better ways of navigating that sort of political terrain. If you have a team that can give you that insight and that kind of even emotional support, because you'll invariably have down days, of course, like everything, to give you that kind of support and feedback, it can really catapult your career. It can really help you grow and evolve sooner, faster, because you're living in a much more networked, feedback kind of environment, rather than just being the only recruiter where your only feedback is hiring managers that love you because you're filling their needs and making their lives easier. So for somebody who aspires to be part of a team, again, they need to articulate stories in their background that demonstrate that they are team players. Even if they were working at McDonald's, they can talk about things that they did to make the team better or make work more efficient or make their manager's job easier. Something that helped the team, something, because I always tell people when they're going for interviews with hiring managers, like, don't go in and say you're a team player. Everybody says that. Who's going to go in and say, I'm an isolationist and I hate working with people. You know, I like to do my own thing. Nobody's going to say that. Everybody says they're a team player. You have to have a story or two ready that articulates that. How were you not an isolationist? How were you contributing to the team? And how did you look out for them? and how did you gain from them? How was it a feedback cycle, a virtuous cycle of giving back and receiving?
So it seems like independence is a requirement because you will be doing your work independently. And just like in most fields, having mentorship will really fuel progress, right? I'm sure if a baby recruiter came and they worked under Jennifer, they would get the special treatment and they would just, you know, they'd blossom a lot faster than by themselves, right? And I've noticed that in my career, I've had bosses that took mentorship seriously and bosses that don't.
Yeah.
And
or don't know how to do it.
Yeah. My boss current boss, actually, she is like the greatest teacher. I mean, financial services are complicated, like banks and how the tech infrastructure for them works is just mind-bogglingly confusing. And so to her to sit down and she gets her like little like iPad and then she goes to the drawing board and then she's like, Omer, look at this and then look at that. And then like in a few years, I'm like, holy, like I'm just so shocked. I know so much about financial services now.
Yeah.
But she takes mentoring really seriously and it's something that you don't find. So I know I tell people like advice in terms of like when they get to their workplace, if you get a good mentor, know that you are lucky. And
yeah, it's really true.
Yeah, it's not something that exists. Like I've worked at four or five places and she is just exceptional. And I didn't know that when I started my career. So mentorship will, like, under good mentorship, you will accomplish what you would, like, 5 years elsewhere, you'll accomplish in, like, a year.
So true.
So, all right. I'm very interested. You said, we talked about this. You know, you answered a lot of questions without me actually asking them. So there's, like, little tidbits. How much does a recruiter earn? And I'm guessing this is obviously such a subjective question, but you mentioned in the beginning that there were multiple methods or means through which you get paid, like contingency and things of that nature. Can you take me through some of the normal payment compensation schemes that recruiters should expect and how do they work?
Yeah. So for a corporate recruiter that's working for a company like I did, you would typically have a base salary and then earn some kind of bonus. That's not always the case. I know when I first started recruiting, I had a base salary and then I earned commissions on each hire. So my base was like barely enough to keep my nose above water and like just barely make my rent and car payment. But then anything extra was all about the commissions. And I studied neuroscience, so I was in a lab. I had never heard of like earning anything more than just your hourly rate. Like you worked, you got paid. You didn't work, you didn't get paid. So to have a base salary and commissions, that just completely motivated me to get as many commissions as possible because it really made a difference on my life. But now I haven't heard of that scheme in a while. So I think most corporate recruiters just get a base salary. They might get some kind of performance bonus. And very often, not at all. Like maybe, you know, you just have to wait for your annual increase or something like that. And these are very important clarifying questions. Once you get to offer stage, it's very important that you're really clear on the compensation. So for headhunters, that is a different game. It can be a really completely different scheme. Some staffing agencies, you don't earn any money except for commissions, but the commissions are very high. So if you place somebody, a client, you could earn 20% commission. So boom, you get a big pay and that's really exciting. But the problem is, where's the next hire coming from? And that's the whole thing about running the full desk. You may have to generate your own leads, find your own clients. So if you're having to find clients and find candidates, you could then get a higher commission because you might get the commission on the client and the candidate. whereas maybe you just get a commission on the hire, the candidate. But it can be really peaks and valleys because you could get a big $10,000 commission check, but then you're dry for another month or two because hiring cycles are about 6 weeks. It typically takes about 6 weeks to get a person from womb to tomb in the hiring life cycle. But not always. And it depends on where you are. And if you're at a startup, it could be 2 weeks. If you're at a bigger company, it can be 2 months. I had candidates at Amazon. Granted, they were at the executive level. They had a lot of experience, which meant a lot of interviews, a lot of vetting. I had candidates in the process 3 months sometimes. So it just depends. Staffing agencies might give a base salary. Maybe it's you have a low base salary, you know, $20,000 per year. I've heard lower, something like that. And then you get commissions on top of that. So it can really vary. Some people are very motivated by that commission. And so they're fine with a low base. Some people prefer a low base because that means a higher commission. Some people, that's nerve-wracking and they want more stability. So they're going for a place that has a higher base and lower commission.
I was under the impression the scheme with the headhunter was the norm. So it seems like that's wrong. If you're a corporate recruiter, you're pretty much getting base. It's like a regular job and you just get, but that it's like it destroys incentive though. It's crazy. I thought that's what, now when a recruiter calls me, I'm going to have a different thought process, you know, because I'm under the impression that each time they lock someone, they're incentivized, right? But clearly they're not. So like if
it depends on who they work for.
So it's like a Robert Half, they would, they're a corporate recruiter and obviously they employ like thousands of people. So,
but Robert Half, I think they have, it's been a long time since I interviewed with them many, many years ago. They typically have a low base. Depends on what level you join. Maybe more junior people join with a low base and higher commission because they do employ so many people and not everybody can make it as a recruiter. So the compensation plan also acts as a filtering method, which sounds cruel, but it's good for the hire as well. You know, if you've got that low base and high commission, you're incentivized to really drive hires and it's like the carrot and it's built to keep you motivated. And as you move up through the ranks there, you get a higher base and slightly lower commissions, but you don't have to chase after that hire as much. So Robert Half is a staffing agency, not a corporate. When I say corporate recruiting, I mean like working for Amazon or working for a law firm. Like there are recruiters that live inside a law firm and they recruit lawyers to work for their law firm. They probably are on a salary.
Makes sense.
A normal livable salary. And then maybe they get some, you know, annual bonus or something like that.
Just like a normal job.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Okay. So that would really dictate what industry you want to join because especially as a headhunter, right? If you join like legal placement, for instance, especially in big law, your 20% commission is going to be large. Whereas if you join like social work, for instance, like it's going to reflect that, right? And so you got to think about that as well. But I guess it's also like how much turnover is in the industry. There's so many factors that...
Where you are in your life. I mean, if you're just young and single and have the flexibility to take tons of risk and you're willing to have that low base, but you can pay your bills, but you want the opportunity to make those high commissions, go for it. That's, I tried that even when I was young and single and didn't have, you know, a mortgage and kids and all those things. It just didn't suit me. It made me so panicked. I felt like for me personally, it skewed my values and I would just try to make a match sooner. Even knowing that it may or may not be a match, I would kind of go into that grandma's noodle test. You're slinging stuff at the wall to see what sticks. For me personally, it just didn't work. I've known headhunters. I have a headhunter I've worked with 15 years and he's amazing. He's not like that. It doesn't give him that fear. He's able to live on a low base and high commissions because he's the bomb. He's so good at his job. For me, it just skewed my thinking. It just didn't work for me. And, you know, so everybody's built differently. You have to figure out what you can stomach and what drives you.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah. So much psychology to it all, really.
Yeah, it's not all that basic. There's a lot of factors going on. I can see why now you said when considering to get into this career, go talk to a headhunter, go talk to a corporate recruiter, ask them questions with respect to...
Talk to many on each side.
Yeah, and that'll help you really hone in on what type of lifestyle, what type of life you want to live.
Yeah, because also people think that recruiting and HR are the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's another big differentiation. In my career, I almost never interacted with HR. HR are typically very different professions. They do often require an undergraduate degree in like business or human resources management. Those people are meant to, they're almost like lawyers in some ways. They're meant to keep things in check. Their job is to keep the company safe and protected and risk-free. So typically HR people are very risk averse. So whenever I'd be at a cocktail party and people would say, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a recruiter. They'd say, oh, you're in HR. And I'd say, no, I'm not in HR at all. Recruiters are the rule breakers. HR are the rule makers.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always said.
That's true. That's true. And I've seen companies without HR and they don't function well.
Right.
Everyone's needed. That's why I'm doing this podcast, because there's so many jobs.
Yeah. There's so many options.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I'm forgetting a question. You said something. I don't think it's going to come to me now. We talked about so many things, but are there any special perks to being a recruiter that you wouldn't know unless you actually became a recruiter?
Yes. I mean, everybody's a candidate. Everybody's a potential. You can go anywhere and you have an automatic reason to talk to anybody. Even if you find out they're not the person that you wanted or that you were interested in, people are interesting. Everybody's got some story. Everybody's got some weird thing going on in their life. And your career is a constant reminder. You can never judge a book by its cover. That's not for the job seeker, though. You want to be the cover that wants to be judged. You want to present yourself that way. But as a recruiter, you realize you never have any idea what's going on in a person's life. You can talk to a candidate that seems like they have got it going on. They've got the degree, they've got the image, the presence, and you find out that their child has cancer at age 2, or that they are a cancer survivor and, you know, all of the things that they've overcome, or, you know, like this kid that I met that did this study on Ecuador. And as soon as he graduated high school, he went down and stayed with the family and helped this small village build this source to water. I mean, just this young guy. So you might see somebody in the grocery store and you just have no idea what's going on with them. You develop a level of empathy. You develop an intelligence, yes, an emotional intelligence, but an actual hardwired intelligence to know that, you know, there's the old adage about the iceberg is you only see the point that's out of the water, but most of the iceberg is actually in the water. As a recruiter, you're so tuned in to the iceberg that's in the water. And you just realize that there's so many more facets to a person. And it's your job to uncover those facets and help a person understand if they will be happy at your organization or at the organization you're hiring for. Because it's so important. You want to be that advocate for the candidate and the advocate for the company. Your job is to fill for the company, but you're helping both to make a match. And so you have this, you have a level of insight that you just couldn't get other places or other ways.
Mm.
that professional nosiness gets you in. You know, you really learn a lot about people.
It's true. It is true. Is the job stressful?
Yeah.
Like what makes it stressful?
Very stressful. Well, there's so many stresses. I mean, you have constant pressure from hiring managers. They always wanted their hire yesterday. You know, you could meet a hiring manager that had a role open for 3 months and they couldn't get budget approval. And so you're starting at the fourth month and you just started working on it because you just got it.
Now it's a you problem.
Yeah. You're stressed because you want to make sure your candidate's going to be happy. One of the things I prided myself on was making a really good match. I had almost zero turnover. When I hired somebody, they stayed at least a year or two, usually much more. And so I felt really good about making those matches. But it's stressful. You want the candidate to be looked after. You don't want them to be treated badly. You don't want the candidate to turn out to be bad and a wrong hire for your hiring manager. There's always time constraints. You're always moving against the clock and trying to help your hiring manager's life be easier. I'll never forget talking to a hiring manager at Amazon, and he confided in me that if he didn't get the role I was working on hired or filled in the next X amount of weeks, he was going to quit Amazon. And he had like a 10-year history. He said he'd had stomach surgery for anxiety and had ulcers and all kinds of stuff. And I lost sleep over him. And it was really, really hard to fill the role because it was so niche and the skill set was so unique. And trying to find the person that had all the perfect characteristics was practically impossible. We did ultimately finally find the person, and she was a match for him made in heaven, thank goodness. But it can be very stressful, but it can also be very rewarding and invigorating. And there's nothing like getting that hire. There's just no feeling like it because everybody wins.
It's like hitting a good golf shot.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
I haven't done that. I've played a lot of golf, but I can't remember a really good golf shot. But
yeah, I mean,
my first eagle was rewarding, but not like getting that really killer hire.
Oh, you've got an eagle? So, I mean, you have to be really good.
I had two eagles in my life. That's it.
Wow. I have none of those. So let's not go golf together. I'll hold you back. I mean, yeah, I can see how it sounds stressful because, I mean, there's so many expectations. There's hiring managers on you. The candidate themselves is like, why aren't you calling me? And then obviously it just... you're wearing a lot of hats. But that's interesting because I was, and you probably don't have this experience, for work-life balance, Forbes said that executive recruiter is the number one job.
That was written by a lazy recruiter.
Yeah. So take me through that. Given it's such a self-motivated, do you think this job actually has work-life balance or not? And like, would you say it's different for a headhunter versus a corporate recruiter? Because I think it would be, right? Because a lot more tools would be required by a headhunter because they don't have an infrastructure, right? Whereas a corporate recruiter actually works within a company and they have so many tools at your disposal to help you do your job.
Well, it can really vary about tools. Like Robert Half has been in business forever. So they probably have tons of tools for their recruiters because all they do is have recruiters, hire recruiters. So one could say that's the best place to learn recruiting because it's a company made for recruiters. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, I don't know about staffing agency versus corporate recruiting having better tools or not. In particular, there can be a good work-life balance for recruiting depending on your manager, depending on your team, depending on where you work. But theoretically, you know, if you had to leave early for a doctor's appointment and you knew you had a lot of follow-up to do, you could do that later in the day or in the evening from home. If you're traveling, I know I can't remember the last vacation that I just had where I didn't work because you don't want to stop the machine. So you could be on vacation, theoretically, in any country, and you're keeping the hiring, the interview process going. You're following up on interviewers that didn't respond. You're working to get those scheduled. You're following up with candidates who had some interviews to find out how they feel about their interviews. You know, you're kind of staying on top of it. So work-life balance has some flexibility, but sometimes your partner might disagree and say, you just work all the time. It's really hard to separate it because at the end of the day, it's all people. You're managing all people and everybody's got a different set of expectations and timelines. And, you know, in some ways it depends on how you define work-life balance. And then it depends on your team or your manager or your company's philosophy, whomever you're working for, what their philosophy is. Maybe they don't want you following up with people while you're out. I had one manager that thought that was unprofessional. I thought that was kind of ridiculous, but you know, maybe he saw it as like, you're on vacation, you should really be out. And maybe that's true too. Maybe that's the better mental health answer. Like if you're out, just go out, really go out and unplug and let somebody else keep on top of everything. And So I think it depends on a lot of factors, but I think to just say the number one best work-life balance profession is recruiting is a really odd blanket statement, and somebody that maybe doesn't work very hard or maybe doesn't really know recruiting.
I think
Send me that article.
I sent it in the link of questions. I don't think like hearing from you, it does not sound like being a corporate recruiter gives you lots of work-life balance. And
being a headhunter could be more stressful because maybe you've got some little measly base salary that's like barely buying groceries. You live for that commission. It's like waiters and waitresses in America. You get nothing. Your paycheck is like nothing. You have to tip people in Europe and maybe Canada. They don't live for the tip. But America's a service industry. If you don't tip them, they may not eat.
Canada is the same thing as America. So in terms of tipping culture. I mean, it sounds like you're just going to shoot yourself one way or another, because the workflow of the job requires so much communication. It seems like you're kind of needed on an on-demand basis, right? Because in the event you're not responsive, then you're kind of hurting your own candidates, chances, everything, and you're breaking the flow that you've created for yourself, right?
That's like, how I see it. You know, everybody's different, but I mean, I used to make a joke that I'm not a control freak. I just like everything done right.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you want, you know, and if you are going to check out, like, you know, you can experience burnout. Burnout is something that recruiters talk to each other about all the time. If you feel yourself approaching that, it's your responsibility to moderate that, not to let yourself get to that point. So if you're going to go on vacation, you need to check out. You owe it to your candidate and your hiring managers to tell them, listen, I have to check out. This isn't an option for me at this point. Everybody understands that, particularly if you're experiencing burnout. It's probably because you've been working really hard for everybody. So They're going to give you that grace. You owe it to yourself and you owe it to the business that you're creating, which is your candidates and your hiring managers, to tell them, I'm going to check out. I will be off the grid for X amount of time. You won't reach me. If there's something emergency, text me, but probably please don't. And everything can stop, but that's the agreement that you make with everybody. Set very clear expectations because you don't want anything to happen to go off the rails while you're checked out. I mean, it could still happen at the end of the day. You're not an emergency room doctor. Yeah. That's another thing I would tell my recruiters that reported to me that would get so worried about leaving the office. I'd say, listen to me. We care deeply about our candidates and our hiring managers and the business and keeping it going and making it better and helping innovation and delivering the best products. But at the end of the day, we're not ER doctors. Nobody will die as a consequence of hour going out of the office and or missing a beat. So you have to keep it in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's funny. Same thing. I'm a lawyer. If I don't respond to an email, no one's going to die. But I tried everything. I would tell people, try and see how you feel. Like, for instance, when I went on vacation, the first two times I went on vacation, I was like, hard no to any emails, right? Did not look at my phone, did not look at my emails. And I came back and I think I had like, it was a full week vacation. It was my best friend's bachelor party. And I came back and I think I had like 300 and something emails.
Yeah.
And
that's the other downfall of totally unplugging.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, half those emails are just like delete, you know? It's not like you actually have to pay attention to them. But the thing is, when you delete them as they come, it's much more palatable for you to come back from vacation.
Ramp on. Yeah.
Whereas, and then I tried the other way, which is like, whenever I go on vacation, I like to throw my phone away because to me, vacation and phones don't coexist. So I would come back every evening and I would look at my phone once and I would just delete all the irrelevant ones. And there's typically like one or two emails. I feel like if I can just forward this to somebody and get the ball rolling, it would really help me on the way back. And it would actually line up perfectly if I just take that one or two like 10 minutes in order to do that. So I started doing that on my vacations because I realized even if my workplace doesn't expect it, it just helps me.
Yeah.
Because when
it
you come back to work,
going.
Yeah. When you come back to work, everyone has high expectations because they're like, oh, you were off a week. Now that you're back, ABC, and they have their wants and needs. And then you have 300 emails to catch up on.
Yeah.
It just, for me, I was like, this is overwhelming.
Totally. And sometimes coming back from vacation, depending on where you go, when you come back, you're jet lagged. You have the post-vacation blues. Sometimes you don't come back like rearing to go. You come back and you're like, I'm back to this again.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you need like your own time to like catch your breath. And, but everybody else has their expectations that you're going to be on fire because you've been on vacation.
Yeah.
So it
a few of my friends are funny with that. They actually take an extra day or two after vacation.
Yeah.
They're all like, I need to truly recharge now. And
yeah.
Then I'll
a vacation
go back and
from the
speed.
Vacation.
Exactly.
Yeah. And anybody who has kids, they would relate to that.
On that note, how many hours do you think a recruiter, like, obviously there it's not static, and given the fact that you can respond to things on off hours, but what's the average work week like for a recruiter that actually cares about their job?
Average hours in a week, I mean, a 5-day work week, you know, I can remember when I was first starting out, I would do interviews on Saturdays, Sundays, especially for the really hard to reach candidates. I would talk to them whenever they would talk to me. I would meet candidates at 7 a.m. for coffee. You know, I would meet them at 7 at night for dinner, you know, whatever it was. So I couldn't even imagine a 40-hour work week, you know, 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 or whatever, because I wanted to produce results. And so I did whatever I had to do. It's really hard to say. I think you get out of it what you put into it.
Hmm. So on that note, if you're a results-oriented person, do you find that in the field there's a lot of turnover, like people that kind of give up after a few months because they haven't been able to achieve the results?
Yes. It can be really hard. I would not say it's a role that has as high of turnover as sales. I think sales is really, you know, and some people will argue, well, sales and recruiting are the same, right? You're selling a job, you're selling a candidate, but it's something that's different. I mean, sales is a product or an idea or a commodity. There is a reason there are millions of books on different sales strategies. It's hard. it is not for the faint at heart, and it's really difficult. At least recruiting has the whole human element, and your product is people, whether it's the hiring manager or the candidate or both. Ultimately, it still has like a softer edge somehow.
Which makes sense why corporate recruiters now have a salary. Because if you did not have a salary, then I think turnover would be too ugly, especially for somebody starting off and not
turnover
having
turnover can still be high if you've got a bad manager and it's a really hard job. But yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, very interesting. So many things go into this stuff. Yeah. I remember in sales, I did a lot of sales over my life. I used to do door-to-door sales. So that was 100% commission.
Yeah.
And I used to work at Best Buy. I used to work at a services company, blah, blah, blah. And I think I figured out sales somewhat. You just have to shut up and listen to the client. And every, you think you know what they want, but no, shut up and listen to them and create a solution for them. And most people appreciate that. I've noticed that. I went to a master dealership once and there was a sales guy there. He was a manager there. And it was incredible how talented this guy was. He just looped me in and he's just like, what do you want to pay? Right. And he's like, it seems like money's a factor. He's like, all our Mazdas typically have like a good, like, you know, interior, blah, 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 this and that. And he's like, just tell me what you want to pay. Tell me what you want monthly, blah, 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 this and that. He's all like, he came back in 15 minutes. He's like, take this car for a spin. He's all like, this is what I think fits you. And he asked me like 15, 20 questions, by the way. I'm just summarizing. And I that experience I was left with, because he was so honed in on what I wanted. And then he's just like, based on everything that you told me, this is how we think we can help you. And anyways, now we're going into sales. But
it's really true.
Yeah.
We used to always say, you have two ears and one mouth for a reason. You should be listening more than talking.
Yeah.
Until it's time to tell the candidate about the job. And then you should tell everything you can.
Wise words. So what do you like or love about being a recruiter?
I love so many things. I love the opportunity to give somebody a new opportunity. You know, I love to help them maybe see new skills or abilities in themselves that they may not have considered. I love talking to the people, getting to know them, learning about so many different industries and career paths that people have taken. I love learning from hiring managers. Some of these people are just crazy brilliant. You don't know how they exist on this planet. Like, you just learn from them and getting to work with really, really brilliant people. I love the strategy that's involved. Like I said, I love the rhombus hire, not the square peg, square hole, but the rhombus. It's really my favorite hire. Knowing the business and the business needs well enough to know that the person that doesn't seem like they would be the perfect, knowing that they are the perfect fit and being able to articulate why they're the perfect fit to the very grumpy, skeptical hiring manager and making that match. And then you start to build teams, you start to put people together and you're like, that is my baby. Look at that. And you see the magic they create and the things that they, the results of all of that. It's very, very gratifying. And you know that you have affected change. You know that your drop in the ocean makes a splash. You're convinced of that. You've helped somebody find a new job, whether they were desperate or not. Some people are desperate and that's rewarding. Maybe they weren't even looking and you found some amazing person and you totally turned their life around. I found this when I was trying to hire when I was trying to build the team in Brazil at McKinsey. It was really, really hard to find the right level of talent that we needed back then because design was still very new in Brazil and the hire had to have consulting background. I mean, the list of requirements in one human was just impossible. And I found this Brazilian guy on LinkedIn in London and I scheduled a call with him. He was very skeptical. I had to chase him forever. And we finally had a conversation. And the first thing I said was, what are you doing there? The climate's terrible. Don't you miss Brazil? And he started laughing and he said, I can't believe you're saying that. My wife and I just had a baby and we're really homesick, but there's no work in Brazil. And I said, there is now. And he was my first senior level hire for McKinsey in Brazil. And he did amazing things. Now he's the chief design officer for the largest bank in Brazil. And he's like rocking it. But there's so many rewarding aspects to recruiting and so many ways that you can affect change and learn and be strategic. And it's very challenging. It's very interesting.
Well, now, what do you dislike about being a recruiter?
I used to really dislike process. I hated it. In fact, I scoffed at it and I thought it was for ninnies. I thought it was such a pile of rubbish and I didn't want anything to do with excessive process. And then I realized that I was in all of the startups that I was implementing process and telling everybody that without a process, I didn't call it process. I think I called it system. And thought that it was something more unique and more different, more agile. Because process sounds so permanent, right? System sounds agile. But it is as difficult as it is important. I dislike, you know, it's hard to say what I dislike. I used to dislike scheduling people because interviewers, you know, you could have a candidate and a hiring manager. And you could have six interviewers in between. And some of those interviewers were required to be part of the process and they would not let you schedule them. They just wouldn't succumb to the need for you scheduling them. Or worse, they would schedule and then reschedule. So then you're managing the candidate expectations. Please don't take this personally. And please don't think we're a terribly rude organization, but we have to shift this. And then you're having to manage all of that. So I used to hate scheduling, but once you kind of get the hang of it, it's not so bad. And ideally you work somewhere where they have people that help you schedule.
Fair enough. That's interesting. I used to think the same thing about process, by the way. It wasn't until I saw a well-oiled machine like Capital One where I was just in awe of how good things worked. And I was like, I love systems. And then I started reading up on, I think I read E-Myth. I'm not sure if you've read the book. It's basically a book on why small businesses fail. And it's just talking about, if you don't have a system, you're gonna fall apart. And it's a really, really cool book. Anyone that is looking into starting a small business or business in general need to kind of think about the different hats that you wear and how to balance them.
Yeah.
And so it's really, really interesting. Same thing with Lean Startup. Lean Startup is like the Bible of startups, right? Yeah. And so it talks about the whole battle between process and systems. So it's really funny. But back to recruiting. Now that you have the controversial number of years of experience, what advice would you give to somebody that's starting off in this field today?
I would say talk to a lot of people, learn about it, and then jump in, try it. You can never lose from trying. And design thinking, failure is your best friend because everything that you try, you learn from. Nothing is ever bad. It might not be an exact fit. It might not be your dream company. But if you're really keen to learn recruiting, maybe you're just in the wrong company. Or maybe you're meant to be a headhunter, not a corporate recruiter. Maybe corporate recruiting is too stuffy for you. Whatever it is, if you're really keen, if there are enough components to recruiting that are interesting for you, stick with it and just try different environments. I know in my early years, I changed jobs like every year because I just couldn't find that exact fit. And then I finally found a place that just hit on maybe, if not all cylinders, most of them. And so just keep that flexible mindset and go after the idea that you're really doing good work, work for good, work that benefits people and work that benefits companies.
You know, you're not the first person that has told me about failure. How do you deal with failure when you're young? Because, I mean, what does a young person hear when they experience failure? They feel rejected. They feel incompetent. They feel invaluable. Bad. Yeah, they feel it's bad. And, you know, everyone that's worked a little bit understands that you need to mess up. You need to fail. It's actually the mistakes that teach you more typically than organic learning. So how do you deal with failure in the field? Like, what do you tell young recruiters when, you know, they get rejected and stuff like that?
I tell them, so there are different kinds of failure. If a young recruiter is experiencing failure in the form of candidates won't accept their calls or candidates won't come in for interview, that's easy because it's probably in your delivery. It's probably something about the way you're saying it, or it's a way that you're approaching a candidate. Maybe you're being too aggressive. You know, when you're first starting out, you're so scared. You just want to make stuff happen. You just want to start producing. So there are ways to tweak your message or your verbiage or how you ask a question and then shut up. Like you said, stop talking, just listen and spend time listening. So there are ways to finesse that. If you're experiencing failure, make sure you understand what specific kind it is, because fortunately or unfortunately, there are many different kinds of failure, because most of them can be evolved. I would say an overarching theme is that failure is always a gift, because it's feedback. It's something in your environment that's telling you this isn't working. So that is a very clear indicator. Okay, I need to tweak this somehow in some way. If it's failure that you're interviewing for jobs and you're just not getting the one that you want, you're either not going after the right kinds of places because you're not a fit for those kind of organizations, or you're not projecting yourself in the way that you want to be perceived. So you have to kind of figure out what the failure is and then dissect and then make changes. And that's the whole design process, really, is that you try things, you have a bias for action. So you're trying things and you're letting the environment, your experiences dictate how things should progress. It informs your decisions, it informs your behavior, and informs what you do. And so you're constantly learning and you're constantly tweaking and perfecting. You know, no product just came out, it was done right the first time. You know, no cake was baked perfectly the first time. You have to like modify the ingredients or modify different things about the product. I was listening to some book about developing the hinge on the laptops and the amount of products that had to be evolved and thrown out to make a hinge that would allow it to be open and closed thousands of times over the course of a laptop's life. And it's so interesting to think, yeah, you don't even think about those hinges. Yeah. Think about door hinges. They aren't opened thousands of times over the course of its hanging. So failure is a good thing. It informs progress. It tells you what the next step should be.
Yeah, I agree. I think failure is the only way to learn. I mean, not the only way to learn, one of the best ways to learn.
It's a form of feedback.
Yeah. So I close all of my podcasts off by asking each candidate, over the course of their life, what is the best career advice you have received?
Wow, that's really hard. I guess my mentor at McKinsey, she was the VP of design, and she was requested to speak at the UX Awards, like one of the main design organizations, you know. And she said she just didn't have time to do it, and she wanted me to do it in her place. I was utterly terrified. I was like, they don't want to hear from me. They want to hear from you. I'm nobody. You're you. And she was like, just try. Just do it. Just figure it out. And I was like, okay. And so I think just figure it out was one of the best pieces of career advice. It sounds simple, but just the idea of like, just put yourself out there, bulldog it. If it doesn't work, try again or not, you know, but just try it. The idea of like, don't just not try it, because the opportunity cost could be tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's great advice. Because when you first enter the field, there's like 1,000 things you don't know. So having that mentality is almost a prerequisite, I feel. Yeah. Try it, fail, and regroup. So
yeah.
And on that note, what is the worst career advice you have ever received? Something that people hear and you'd be like, no, that is wrong.
So I was talking to a recruiter, and I was early in my career and trying to really find my way. I was working for a company that it was kind of boring. I liked the recruiting aspects of it, but I felt like the company itself was just not my jam for whatever reason. And I was interviewing with this recruiter, and like I said, I studied neuroscience in undergrad and had a lot of publications and things like that, and was talking to her about the fact that I was considering getting a master's degree. And she was like, what's with all this education? You know, I don't get it. You just don't need it. And I thought, no, I will not be considering your company, because I love education. I mean, my master's degrees don't necessarily directly line up, or they didn't when I was doing them. And I still want a PhD in architecture, and that doesn't necessarily look like a beeline to recruiting or executive coaching, but who cares? Education is, you're never going to regret education. Like, oh, I wish I hadn't learned that, unless it was something terrible or hurtful. Maybe you wish you didn't learn it. But beyond that, I mean, education is always a good thing. You can always find a way to weave it into your story. It's still part of you. It's still relevant. So that was the worst piece of advice, is that I didn't need education.
It's interesting. I think you're very talented at taking anything and seeing the positive. And actually, you know, you mentioned being a very good storyteller, and you teach people how to do that. And I can truly see that, because I have interviewed other people, and for them, it was like, education should only be considered if it's going to provide some value, right? And mm-hmm. there's lots of useless degrees out there, and make sure you actually get paid. And so, I mean, it's just interesting how you can perceive the same exact situation completely differently. And I agree. Most pieces of education, there's so many intangibles to educational value that comes indirectly out of just getting that education itself, and you don't realize it. The thing is, I think people expect immediate results, but that education will somehow be leveraged 10 years later, 5 years later. You don't really know. So
I think what I've learned is that life is just a layering process. You want to be, I don't know why, I always thought about, you want to be at a cocktail party and be able to talk about anything. Mm-hmm. I remember in undergrad, I was almost near graduation and went to the guidance counselor kind of on an impulse, thinking like, I should probably do this, and to make sure I had enough credits with everything, even though I knew I was on track to graduate, no problem, and learned I had 2 culture credits that I had to take. They were required, which means a full year of culture credits. I was shocked and terrified how I was going to squeeze in 2 classes I didn't even know I needed. They were really outside my realm, and there were none of it. All of the ones that were interesting to me were full. I couldn't squeeze in. I could only squeeze into Russian literature and Russian art history, and they were very distinct time periods. And I thought, well, I don't know anything about anything Russia, and I don't know anything about Russian art or Russian literature. To this day, there were two of the most useful classes I've ever taken. I had Russian candidates in my first recruiting job in Chicago that were highly sought after because there are a lot of very strong Russian software engineers even now, as we know. And this one guy in particular that was commanding this shocking hourly rate, nobody could get him. And he took my call and we had this amazing chat and he joined my firm only because our first conversation was about Dostoevsky. It was nothing to do with the company or the job or anything. And I talked to my husband, we went to a client dinner. He's a lawyer and she was Russian, living in Italy. And she ended up doing all this work with him because she and I had this lengthy conversation over dinner about the powers of propagandistic art. And she was a Russian art history expert. And we had this whole debate about how propaganda is supposed to be bad, but it can be good, and the societal implications and all of that. And there I was. So education is always worth it. You, in my opinion, you should never, ever regret education. It's all in you. It's all layering. It's all some added facet. And facets are always good because it's an opportunity to have something else to expose you to, some other door opener. You don't even know what that door is. It doesn't matter. But education is always good. Always.
I like that. You should talk to Charlie Kirk. He's been going to campuses and telling people education is a complete waste and a scam.
Really?
Yeah, it's interesting.
That feels like sacrilege to me.
It's just a very different perspective. But he's a bright chap, and he loves debating. And he himself, I believe, dropped out of college. Right. I'm not 100% sure about him. And you know, there's individuals out there that can find success in anything that they do.
I've known them.
And,
yeah.
And so,
education isn't one of them.
Yeah. So he's pretty much a living embodiment of somebody that can succeed. Without that, he's an author. He debates people left, right, and center, and he's
good for
really
him.
Good. Yeah, he's good. He's a bright guy, a bright kid. But his message is, I find that it's just, I think it's very easy to get caught into, right? Because everyone wants, exactly. It's very easy. And like some of the people have asked him questions with respect to how can it be a scam if half the market out there has like a university degree as a prerequisite to getting a job. But you do also see the market is kind of dwindling and it's going certificate based and, you know, they're making it lower barriers of entry to reflect, you know, anyways,
I think that is the democratization of education. And that's a good thing because not everybody has access to university. It's ridiculously expensive in this country. It's not accessible to everybody. So if there are more certificate programs, that's great. My son is a sophomore in high school and he knows kids that don't even think of college or university or anything. It's not even an option. It never has been. Nobody in their family went, some of these kids. And the fact that they might be able to get a certificate is great. And so I reiterate my message, which is no education is bad education. But that's not to say that education is a requirement. But this guy, not everybody can be that guy. So spreading that message could tell a bunch of kids to quit school and then they just don't do anything with their lives because they don't have the same abilities that he did. Maybe he just had bad experiences in school and teachers telling him he's dumb because he has an undiagnosed learning disability, you know, but he has extreme other abilities that maybe the average bear who needs to stay in school and get a degree doesn't have. So I think...
Yeah.
I think it's very scary to be too opinionated.
Yeah.
But I will say that no, I don't think you should regret any education. Like nobody should ever come away like, oh, I wish I didn't get that degree. Get a different degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what social media is about, right? You can put out whatever opinion that you want and to the extent you want to challenge it, right? And yeah. He actually opens debates for anybody. He's like, come debate me. Actually, his platform. So if you're ever interested, check him out. Challenge him, maybe.
I'm going to check him out.
All right, Jennifer. It was an absolute pleasure learning about the career of an executive recruiter. I hope people like it as well.
Me too.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you today.
Awesome. Have a good one.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Well, that's it for this episode of the My Career Shop podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And I hope you have a much better idea of how to become a recruiter and what to expect once you actually become one. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe button, leave a review, and comment on what professions you want me to invite next and what other information you would be interested in learning. Until next time.